Forecast from the National Weather Service calling for sunny skies today, helping us dry out from the weekend. A high of 48, northwest winds at 10 to 20, clear and colder tonight, a low around 28. Then for tomorrow, sunny skies, a high of 40 near Lake Michigan, 45 in Walworth County. The expanded forecast, dry weather expected to continue right on through the weekend. And we can enjoy a warming trend this week. By Sunday, we should be in the mid-60s. Right now, 49 degrees in Kenosha, 39 in Burlington, winds out of the west at 9 miles an hour. I'm David Cole, WGTD News. The morning show coming up.
Support for the morning show comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses are designed for the working adult. More information at carthage.edu/grad. Support also comes from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, a unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe, Andrea's, 2401 60th Street, online at andreasgifts.com. And we welcome you to the Monday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. Here's part one of today's program. And it's certainly exciting to have the opportunity to speak for the next few minutes with best-selling author Peter Laranjus. He is a prolific author and wildly successful, particularly with a series of books called Seven Wonders. And the fifth and final in that series, The Legend of the Rift, has just come out. And this is a series of books intended for young readers, but people of all ages have been gobbling up the books of this Seven Wonders series. And it's very, very exciting to be able to speak with Peter Laranjus about this series of books and everything else that he has created through his very, very busy life and career. Peter Laranjus, we welcome you to the morning show.
Oh, thanks, Greg. You're too kind. I'm happy to talk to you. And I got to say, I love Milwaukee, and I'm going to be there in a couple of weeks, and I can't wait.
Excellent. So how does somebody who studied biochemistry in college and spent a lot of time on the stage as an actor end up being such a prolific and successful author? How does all of this fit together for you?
Well, all the other stuff was a detour for this, I think. I always knew that I wanted to be a writer, even when I was a little boy. But you know, as you grow up, you face reality. You know, you come up with all these truisms, and one of the truisms is, you know, you can't make a living as a writer. It's you know, only a fraction of 1% actually do that. So I kind of intimidated myself out of trying to do that, and I kind of went into other things. I loved the sciences. Majored in biochemistry, but I never wanted to be a doctor, and I never really wanted to do research, so it wasn't really a place for me, but I loved studying that stuff. I toyed with the idea of going to law school. I even got into law school, and I said to myself, okay, Peter, you're in, right? Give yourself a year. Defer your enrollment and take a year and try to do something that you really love to do, and you have something in your back pocket in case you fail, right? So I always wanted to be a performer, and I always wanted to be a writer. So I started with the performing thing first, and within 1 year, I got into a Broadway show, and I figured, okay, I'm not going to go to law school, you know, and that was that. And as part of my journey as an actor, I ended up at a theater in Milwaukee, as a matter of fact. Two summers, I was in a theater that no longer exists called the Milwaukee Melody Top. I did about 8, maybe more, musical theater, and had a great time spending summers there. And then eventually, in between my acting jobs, I went back to the thing I always wanted to do, which was writing. And before long, I had to make a choice. I was married, I wanted to have a family, and I thought, well, you know, I could keep trying to be an actor and, you know, leaving home and, getting rejected all the time, or I could go into writing, and that was really starting to become so satisfying, and I really felt that that's the thing I wanted, that's the basket I wanted to put my eggs in, and I haven't looked back ever since. Mm-hmm.
This series called Seven Wonders has, of course, been spectacularly successful. I wonder if you could just say a word, first of all, about what you think about when you write with younger readers in mind. What is it that you set about doing that allows you to click with younger readers so well?
Yeah, I mean, it's the thing. I still remember so vividly what it was like to be that age and the kinds of things that I thought about. And that always stayed alive inside of me. I don't know why. You know, we're all a little bit different that way. But the idea that you're at a point in your life where, you know, even the most basic questions, what's right, what's wrong, you know, what happened when a friend who you really, really like betrays you? Why does that happen? You know, why does somebody have to move away after you've become great friends? All of the things that, all those concerns stayed with me. Plus, I love action-adventure. I used to love to read that kind of stuff. And one day when I was, 10 years old, I was reading a story by Jack London called To Build a Fire. It was a 90-degree day. We didn't have air conditioning. And I was reading this book, and it took place in the far north, a man surviving in the snow with his dog. And all of a sudden, I felt myself shivering with the cold, and it was 90 degrees outside. And I thought, wow, I want to do this. I want to be able to move people physically just by using words. If I could do that, that would be the most awesome thing in the world. It took a long time to get there, but I really felt connected to those kinds of stories that I loved when I was a kid. Hmm.
You have created a universe in which magic coexists with just everyday life. I mean, magic in a world of cell phones. And of course, at the heart of this story are young people who are working to try to, in a sense, save the planet from the way that things have gone dangerously awry. Just talk for a moment about the world itself that we find in Seven Wonders and the care with which you created it.
Oh, right. Well, at the very beginning of the story, you've got four kids who are finding themselves on an island in the middle of nowhere. They don't know how they got there. They don't know why they're there. All they know is that there are all these people walking around in lab coats. Well, of course, they're subjects of a study. It turns out that they are all descended from a prince who escaped the sinking of the continent of Atlantis centuries ago, right? And this prince had a gene that they've inherited now. What this gene does is it takes whatever you're already good at and turns it into a superpower. So if you're a good athlete, you're, you know, sinking jump shots from 50 yards. If you're really good at computers, you can hack into anything. That's the power of this gene. But it's got a dark side. Anybody who's ever had this characteristic has never lived past the age of 14. Well, all these kids are 13 years old. They've got 1 year. And on this island, they've found a cure. Now, if these kids can go and find seven magical objects that were taken from Atlantis before it sank by this prince and hidden in the seven wonders of the ancient world, which were built for that purpose, and they bring these objects back to this island, they will be cured and they'll live great, long, awesome lives. And also, as it turns out, they will save the world. Well, how do they do that? You know, of the seven wonders of the ancient world, six of them no longer exist, right? Just the pyramids of Egypt. Those are the only ones. So how do you bring back to life these six ancient structures in order to bring yourself back to life? And how do you do it when the personalities of these four kids are so different? Our hero, Jack, he's an ordinary kid. He doesn't know what his special talent is. He doesn't know what this gene is going to do to him. He doesn't have any special talent. Well, he has to find out what that talent is. And these kids have to do this as a team, and it's an impossible task, and there's magic, and there's fantasy and action and adventure, and by the end of book four, the whole thing has completely fallen apart. Two of the objects are destroyed. The island is about to be destroyed itself, and there's just no way by the end of book four that this thing is ever going to happen. And that's kind of the task I set for myself for the last book, book five, and that's actually what's bringing me out on tour. The book comes out tomorrow, the 8th, and I get to go to 10 different cities or 11 different cities and talk to kids and find out what they really think.
And, of course, one of the things that's especially delicious about the way you've written this story is that you have brothers and sisters squabbling and children and their complicated relationships with their parents and so on. I mean,
right.
You've really tried to cast these young people in some ways as heroic figures and yet as very real and authentic as well.
Well, that's what I try to do, because if you write series where each of the characters have kind of impossible abilities, right? You know, you run the risk of being too cartoony. And what I think brings literature to life, and what I really love reading, is characters who feel like people you can meet in the street. So yeah, that for me was one of my great goals, was to make characters that the kids could identify with.
The Legend of the Rift is the fifth and final book in the Seven Wonders series by Peter Laranjus. Peter Laranjus, congratulations on your spectacular success, and thank you for joining me today on The Morning Show. Best wishes to you, and happy writing.
Thanks, Greg. Pleasure to be here.
It's 8:21, and you're listening to The Morning Show on WGTD-HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva, your gateway to public radio. Over the last couple of days, I have been devouring a fascinating and moving book called Saving Delaney, From Surrogacy to Family. There is a plethora of sort of complicated personal issues that are involved in any story of surrogate parenting. And it's something that, of course, as technology continues to advance, becomes more and more a part of sort of the scheme of things. But that doesn't simplify some of the really delicate, complicated questions that often arise. So right there, this is an interesting story, Saving Delaney, because it tells the story of surrogacy. However, it has a couple of other layers of let's say, complication to it. One of them being that we are talking about a lesbian couple, Andrea and Keston Atdal, and we are talking about a surrogacy agreement with two other women that, in a sense, went sour the moment that some tests were done that indicated that the baby that Andrea was carrying was, in fact, going to be Down syndrome. And this set in motion, then, a very difficult new path for Andrea and Keston, who made the decision that even though the women with whom this surrogacy agreement had been brokered wanted this pregnancy to be terminated, they decided that they wanted to go ahead. And indeed, Delaney has been born, is alive and well, and she, of course, is the crowning glory of this wonderful story, told in this really touching and interesting memoir called, again, Saving Delaney from Surrogacy to From Surrogacy to Family, published by Kleist Press. And I'm very, very excited to have with me on the phone both Andrea and Keston Atdal to talk about their story and about their book. Andrea and Keston Atdal, we welcome you to The Morning Show.
Oh, thank you, Greg. Actually, it's just going to be me. Andrea had to leave.
Oh, well, okay.
That's what happens when you have a baby.
Understood. Well, it's good to be talking to you, Keston Atdal. I wanted to ask you right off the bat about the fact that both of your names appear on the cover of the book, but the book is told from your perspective. It is as though you are the narrator. Could you just say a word about how the book took shape and to what extent the two of you, in fact, co-authored it?
Sorry about that. Mm-hmm. Well, you know, if you read the intro to the book too, Andrea co-wrote the book because I'm a demon writer. I'll drink a glass of wine and I'll just write, and then I give whatever I've written to Andrea, and she's my technical writer, and the story really is hers as well. So we felt it was important to have it her be the author, co-author on the title as well.
Very good. Was it at all difficult to write this story in the midst of it, after all, still living this story, and also the fact that it touches on some really complicated and delicate, highly personal matters? I mean, especially as you began writing this book, did you feel any trepidation about just how complicated this story was and how important it was, in a sense, to really get it right and to be respectful of all parties concerned?
Oh, gosh, yes. I mean, when we wrote it, or when I wrote it, it was right as Delaney was being born. And we waited to write the last chapter until she was born. But it was in the midst of, I think I cried every day, and every time I sat down and wrote, I cried. And not because the story was just so emotional, but I felt bad for like the intended moms. And while it was triumphant for Andrea and I and Delaney, it was really hard for them. And I knew I had to tell their story too. And we had a lot of reservations about it, but we just felt that in sharing Delaney's story, it's not an LGBT story. It's not a Down syndrome story. This is a human interest story. And I changed because of Delaney. And there are a lot of people that are afraid of people like Delaney. Obviously, 9 out of 10 are terminated when they're pregnant and it's diagnosed that they have Down syndrome. And it's a very quiet discrimination that still exists. And we just knew that we had to write this story, because it was so important.
And you've done a really, really fine job with it, I must say.
Thank you.
You share a lot about your own background and some of the complications that have been part of your life, including something you spell out at one point in the first chapter of the book, that by the time you were 20, you had been married, divorced, and were a single mom.
Yeah.
Can you just say a word about... well, I termed it a kind of a complicated start to your life. What was going on there that kind of led you down that particular path in the early going of your young adulthood?
Everything that made me who I was my mother. And the book reads as a love story between Andre and I and Delaney and Andre and I, but also it's a tribute to my mom, and my mom shaped who I was, and I lived my life. She was such an amazing woman, and in her time, you know, worked 3 jobs to support 5 kids, so I lived in her shadow, and I lived to please her and to be like her and emulate her. And she herself was married young and divorced young and had a kid young, and I found myself, and I'm sure a lot of people do who admire their parents, I found myself living in her shadow and making the same mistakes.
It's an interesting story about you and your mother and your particular relationship. I wonder if you could just say a word about why that relationship was as important as it was, and why it figures as prominently as it does in this book. Since obviously that relationship is not the heart and soul of the story of Delaney, but it obviously figures very much in who you are and in a sense how this experience ultimately played out for you.
The stars lined up for us and for me to make this decision. And as you read the book, Andrea told me it was my decision. And my mom had such a pivotal role because I had just lost her, and you know, my mom and I fought for 10 years to keep her alive. She had COPD, and in the end, I gave up on her, and I felt tremendous guilt for giving up on her. And after she passed away, and I can't be the only person who talks to my dead mother, because I talk to her every day, I feel like she's there, and especially during this time, because she she was such a, I took her advice in everything. I emulated her in everything because she was such a great woman. And I knew that she would have thought people like Delaney were imbeciles because that's what she, how she was raised. They were always institutionalized. She never saw them. And I could hear her in my head, you know, telling me, Keston, what are you doing? Why are you hesitating? You're going to ruin your life. And I could hear her. And in the moments that I restarted researching about Down syndrome and I realized all the advances had been made and I realized Delaney could have a wonderful life if I gave that to her. In those moments, I emerged from my mom's shadow and I realized that I could be a better person. And my mom just had a lot to do with who I was as a person. And in Saving Delaney and in the book, I discovered my own voice.
How difficult was it for you as you wrote this book to own up to your own really intense bigotry when it came to, for instance, adults with developmental disabilities, people with, for instance, Down syndrome? It's one thing to kind of realize that about oneself. It's another thing to, in a sense, share it with the whole world. and you do so very, very frankly, very, very honestly. What kind of experience, though, was that for you to have to, in a sense, admit that so freely and openly?
God, I look back and I'm so ashamed. I didn't even realize I took the kids to a pumpkin patch and I wanted to leave because a group of kids there with Down syndrome were there having fun and I was scared of them. I felt they were real-life inspirations for monster movies because that's how I was raised. You know, back in the 70s and the 80s, you didn't see people like this. And I didn't realize that I myself was a bigot. And it just, it's eye-opening when you see, you look in the mirror and you think you're this great person. And, I mean, I work with the homeless and I do all this great stuff. I teach my children to be socially responsible. And then I have this nasty trait, and I didn't even realize it until later in my life. And then I just thought, well, you know, everybody feels this way. Look, you can see it in the news. Everybody, a lot of people feel this way, so I'm okay. But I wasn't okay. And God had a higher power, and I had a higher power believe in me. And he gave us Delaney so that I can open my eyes and see that I can be a better person.
One of the most painful moments in the book is when you share a reunion of sorts, which occurred with your sister, Rhonda,
yeah.
And someone you had not been with in quite some time. Rhonda suffered from repeated brain aneurysms, and until you actually saw her for, the first time in well over a decade, you had no idea what kind of damage had been done to her. Just say a word about that encounter with Rhonda and what kind of a difference you think that made in all of this.
Well, Rhonda just reiterated my fear. I expected to see my beautiful sister, and I understood that she was in a hospital, and I went to go visit her, and she had clearly had some brain damage. And after not seeing her for 10 years, I was prepared to see my beautiful intellectual sister, and she still is intellectual, by the way. But I didn't even recognize her, and it was just, it was so hard, and it just reiterated to me my own fear. Now, at the time, I should have overcome my fear at that point. This was my sister, and I should have overcome my fear of disabled people at that point, but I didn't. It took this amazing little baby to open my eyes.
We're speaking with Keston Ottdahl and talking about the book she has co-authored called Saving Delaney, From Surrogacy to Family, before talking about how little Delaney came into the world. We need to talk about you meeting Andrea, your life partner. Ahead of that, as you are describing kind of what your life was like once you had finally come out yourself as a lesbian, you describe yourself as, in those so-called single days, as being a self-proclaimed queen bee who ended up being, among other things, a friend of the friendless. Can you just say a word about what you mean by Queen Bee and about the way in which you kind of lived your life in those days before you met Andrea?
Sure. Well, I sang Led Zeppelin in a rock band, and I was a queen bee because I had so many friends. Everybody flocked to my parties. Everybody wanted to hang out with me. And I was, you know, I was done raising my children, and I was ready to party when I met Andrea. And she had come to a party and saw me sing, and she's 16 years younger than me, by the way, and which I told her, oh, my gosh, you're too young for me. And she said, no, you're actually, you're going to go, we're going to be together. And she said, I just know it. And who could resist that? And I my life changed instantly because she had two small children, and I found myself no longer a queen bee, and people no longer wanted to come with my parties because they included children. So, yeah, my life changed drastically. You know, they say God laughs at plans. And boy, did he laughed at mine.
So describe to our listeners how these two women came into your life and how this process of Andrea becoming a surrogate for them all began.
Well, you know, we try to treat people. I live my life, and I did it even then without with my take apart my discrimination against people with disabilities. But I try to do right by people and good by people. And we had met them at a party, and Andrea was old friends with them, and they were talking about how they had been trying to have a baby for 10 years, or maybe it was 7 years, and their eggs were bad, and they couldn't adopt. Nobody wanted to let them adopt because they were gay, you know, lesbian parents. And they're just, I mean, it was so heartfelt and touching, their story of their plight to have a baby. And Andrea just told me, you know, she blurted out at the party, Kesson, I want a surrogate for them. And I was like, oh my gosh, no way. But she said she felt like she was doing a good thing, and I had to support that.
Hmm. You had some misgivings, and one of the things you said to Andrea as you were having one of your first conversations, you said, we still really don't know these women. We know what they're saying, but we don't know them. I think that's such an interesting distinction. That really, in a sense, hits it right on the head. That people probably all the time find themselves in a similar sort of situation. Maybe not around something as complicated as surrogacy, but in all kinds of ways. Are you going to rent your basement to this stranger and so on? And this idea that yes, you hear the words they're saying, but that doesn't mean you know really who they are. And here you were entering into something so delicate, so complex, with people who, to a large extent, were still complete strangers to you.
They were. You know, you don't know people, really. I mean, unless you live with them every day. And it was, you know, they looked good on paper. They looked good visually. But we didn't really know them. And that worried me. But Andrea was just, you know, they had gone through so much to make their dreams come true. And anybody who wants a baby that much, we felt, deserved a chance to be a parent.
Hmm. It was interesting to read in your book about how your agreement was drawn up. An agreement which, among other things, was a financial arrangement in which Andrea was compensated. Just talk for a moment about what a complicated process that was and the sort of agreement that ultimately was drawn up, and whether or not, in retrospect, it's an agreement that you feel good about.
I don't feel good about it anymore. You hire a surrogacy attorney, and they hired the surrogacy attorney to draw up the paperwork, and they're a great attorney. Nothing against attorney, but they use language and clauses that, like, we signed the clause saying that for medical reasons, we would terminate the pregnancy upon the intended parent's request. That's a hypothetical, and I think it should be illegal to put that even in the contract. So when they decided they wanted us to terminate for medical reasons, we were like, well, let's look at the medical reasons. When a woman has a baby growing inside of her, to to hypothetically ahead of time request her to terminate or have her sign that she'll terminate is ridiculous. Because emotions happen when you're pregnant, and I don't care if it's your biological child or not. That clause should not be in any contract. And that's something actually that I want to take to Washington, D.C. That should not exist in any surrogacy. It to me, it even undermines surrogacy in its entirety. Because you can't tell somebody to terminate a child and do something with their body, and the hypothetical is just ridiculous.
As you describe the signing of this contract and then the process beginning, one thing that is really sort of amazing and wrenching for you to experience at the time and for us to even read about it all these years later is how difficult it was for Andrea to ultimately get pregnant, and how terribly guilty she felt, how badly she felt for this other couple for whom she was wanting to do this. Can you just say a word about that really, really difficult period before finally Andrea was able to get pregnant, and just how long we're talking?
Well, it took 7 months, and each month it was costing these women a small fortune. We did not expect Andrea to have fertility problems because she has two kids, and she, you know, we just, that was not in the cards. We expected it to be maybe once or twice, not seven times. And every month, you know, these women were forking out all this money, and to doctors, not to us, by the way. We weren't, we didn't get paid. But they were forking all this money out for frozen sperm and for fertility doctors and all that stuff. And it was very hard.
There's also the interesting question of where the sperm or from whom the sperm was going to come. And I'd never really stopped to think about that, just how complicated a matter that might be, even for you at that point, not thinking that you would be actually parenting this as yet unborn child. Just talk a moment about that, about how kind of complicated that was and how complicated it turned out to be in the case of Delaney.
Well, as you know, we started with the frozen sperm, and it's $600 a vial. It's not cheap. And as our guilt was, you know, raising for not getting pregnant, I mean, Andrea, poor Andrea, she'd get her period and she would just cry. And she knew she'd have to tell them, oh, it didn't work this time. So we eventually, they wanted to have their friends, and they wanted us to approach our friends that might be interested in donating. And considering that this wasn't our baby, I mean, we didn't even think about it. And of course, we ended up with the baby, and she's perfect. She looks just like our other kids. But that was interesting. It was hard.
Right. Ultimately, of course, Andrea does finally become pregnant. And of course, that was a joyous day all around. Remind me, how at what point in her pregnancy was there first an indication that there might be something amiss?
There was none right up until that test.
And at what point did that occur? How far after? How long after she became pregnant?
Delaney was 12 weeks gestation. We went for an ultrasound test, and we had gone through so much to make this baby, and this baby was made with so much love. When we were offered to do this ultrasound test to check for genetic abnormalities, that was the furthest thing from our mind. It was a routine test. We just wanted to go see the baby up on the monitor, and we were thrilled, and she was perfect. And she had a beautiful profile, and she was spinning around and, you know, jumping or moving her legs, and we joked about how she looked like a basketball player, and we were, the two women were planning her future. And then a doctor came in, the technician excused herself and left, and the big doctor came in, and he said, "This is where parents typically terminate, and I would be happy to terminate today if you need me to," basically. And we were just like, "What? Hold on. Now you're squashing our dreams." And he explained that he believes it's Down syndrome or worse, and he could do more testing to confirm that, but he said it was Down syndrome or worse. And then he gave us a gamut a list of everything that could go wrong with this baby. Blind, she's going to have a deformity on the back of her head. She's, I mean, heart problems, you name it, he listed it.
Hmm. At that point, of course, a very difficult decision needed to be made, although ultimately I think for you and Andrea, you sort of felt like it was the only decision you could make, but nevertheless, you were faced with a stark choice about whether or not to go forward with this pregnancy. And, of course, it was not just a question for the two of you. It was a question also for Erica and Liz, that's what you call them, this couple who had brokered this surrogacy arrangement. And I had not really stopped to think about it until I read through your story how this was such a difficult matter, and the four of you were not at all in the same place. What about you and Andrea? How quickly and easily did you come to be in the same place in believing that you needed to go forward with this pregnancy? Was that an agreement arrived at quickly and easily, or only with some difficulty?
It was. It was strange. You know, that we went over the weekend when we wanted the test results, and I scoured the internet to find out how the doctor could be wrong. And it wasn't Down syndrome. I just convinced myself it wasn't Down syndrome. And then that Monday morning, we got the call. Andrea was, I would say she was semi-catatonic. I mean, she felt that God was punishing her. She had done something that, you know, went out of her way to make these women's dreams come true. And it was a failure. And it was heartbreaking. But there was a little person involved now. And In my love for Andrea, and I saw how devastated she was. She sat in bed on the internet, just researching, just crying the entire weekend. And I looked at her, and I knew that we would have to make the right decision, and it couldn't be based on my fears of disabled people, and it couldn't be based on Liz and Erica, because it wasn't about them anymore. And Andrea told me, you know, whatever we do, it's going to be up to you. And Liz and Erica told me that it's their decision and their decision alone, and we need to respect it. And I could only say that, actually, dear, no, it's not your decision alone. And I let them know that if they didn't want the baby, that we're going to keep it. But in the moments that we found, after we found out that Delaney did, yes, have Down syndrome, all Andrea asked me to do was watch videos with her of children with Down syndrome and what's been happening in today's world with Down syndrome. It's not what it used to be. And I sat, and all I can say, and I'm going to try not to tear up, but I felt like the Grinch. I felt my heart grow three sizes. Hmm. And I felt an awareness come over me. And I realized that I love this baby. She is a fighter. And she has survived so much already. And I grew my inner mama bear. And I just said, you know what? Nobody is going to take away her chance. If she passes away on her own, that's going to be up to her. And in those moments, I realized that Andrea and I were her moms.
One further complication as the pregnancy goes forward comes from the two men, the couple who had, in a sense, sort of between them, presumably provided the sperm. I think you call them Rod and Sean.
Mm-hmm.
And their sort of waxing and waning interest in this baby, and their sort of up and down interest in perhaps being a part of her life, ended up being a huge complication and source of frustration for you and Andrea. Plus, it opened up a really sort of complicated can of worms in terms of what their rights might be versus yours and so on. And they did also, from the way you describe it, seem to be entering into these complicated matters with a fair amount of naivete. Just talk for a moment about what that experience specifically was like to sort of have to weather in a situation that was already pretty complicated and challenging.
Well, those two donors, they were missing in action. I mean, when all this was going down and we found out, the four women, us, found out that Delaney had Down syndrome, those guys were nowhere to be found. And they, I mean, we would try to contact them and say, hey, you guys still want to be uncles? They were supposed to be uncles. And they rarely returned our texts or emails or, you know, rarely called us. We didn't hear from them. So then all of a sudden they go off on some Hawaiian vacation and came back with some revelation that they want to be the dads. And we were like, wait, hold on. First of all, we don't know who's the donor, really. And second of all, where have you been? And I mean, because they did not call one time. We knew Delaney had a heart problem, and they did not call one time to find out how the baby was doing. They came out of left field, you know, way into it, and it was really shocking, to be honest with you.
Ultimately, they step back, and this becomes a journey for you and Andrea, and of course, for your respective families. And that's, of course, another source of pain in all of this, is that your families, although to some extent they've tried to be supportive, have not been perfectly supportive, to say the least. Just say a word about that, and also about how tricky it probably was to write about that.
Ooh, you know what? As a writer, I had to dismiss my loyalties to my family. And I think maybe that sounds really terrible, but if you're going to tell the story and you're going to tell the truth, we took absolutely no literary license in this book. And most of everything that we have is written in text or emails. So, I mean, we took it verbatim, word for word. And I worry about how her family and my family, my son wasn't happy either. But I worry about how they're going to receive the book, because they're not written in beautifully. Andrea's mother came around, but her father really did not quite come around. He thought that Delaney was going to ruin our lives and that our children were going to be teased because they have a little sister with Down syndrome. And he never really came around. Today, he's better. He's not wonderful, but he's better. But that was so hard because, I mean, here we had decided we're going to save this baby and we're going to keep this baby. We are her parents. We had gone through so much already. But we did not have any support. It was just Andrea, Delaney, and I, and our two kids, Jared and Juliana, against the world. And we had no other support. It was hard. But I'll tell you, Greg, we never looked back, and we were always proud of every moment from that minute on. It was almost as if we didn't need their support, because we knew in our hearts what we were doing was going to be okay.
Hmm. One thing that was very gratifying for you was the response of your son, Jared, and I forget if he was 6 or 7 years old, but I think the way you describe it, you did a wonderful job of explaining to him just, you know, what this was all about. I mean, why you were going to be keeping this baby, why this other couple was not going to be keeping them. They were a little scared and the baby would be sick, but you were going to take care of her. And almost immediately, young Jared sees himself as a fierce protector of this yet as unborn baby sister of his. Talk for a moment about the role that Jared has played in all of this.
And he still is, by the way. He is so good with Delaney. I'm so proud of him. You know, here we tell him, Mama's going to get pregnant for our friends, and it's not going to be your little sister. And then after everything that happened, we had to backtrack and tell him that actually Mama is pregnant and the baby's going to, we're going to keep the baby. It is going to be your little sister. And we told him that the baby was sick, and we told him she had Down syndrome. But then I realized he doesn't know what Down syndrome is. So I played him some of the same videos that Andrea made me watch. And he understands bullying, and he understands that she might be bullied. And he said, I'm not going to let that happen. And he was like us. We had our inner mama bear, and Jared had his big brother bear. It was amazing. And it still is.
Mm. So we follow in your book through this pregnancy, through the delivery, which is not particularly easy, but Delaney eventually arrives.
Yeah.
Tell us how Delaney is doing now.
Oh, my God. You know, we started, Greg, instead of terminating her, we started early intervention, and we started taking choline, which is a brain supplement, so that as her brain is developing, she has a better chance. And we also started her early intervention. I had her in therapy at 2 months, and it's paying off in spades. Delaney, developmentally, is on target with typical babies without her disability. She, typically, kids with Down syndrome don't even talk until they're almost five. Delaney says, you know, five-word sentences, and she's 2.5. She is smart as a whip, as if she didn't even have Down syndrome. We love, I mean, all kids with Down syndrome have the capacity to do anything you want them to do if you help them and you do not limit them and you get them proper early intervention. And Delaney is a fantastic little role model. She is just, she's just a hero to so many.
I know that you have done an extensive amount of blogging, and that that's another way in which people can have already followed your story, even ahead of the publication of this book. Are you still finding the time to do that?
Oh yeah, we have to, we make time.
Mm-hmm.
The story is so important and so powerful that you know our end goal. I always tell myself the eye on the prize is to help other people, and by doing that, we blog. I blog for the Huffington Post. We've been in the Washington Post. We're all over.
And now people can read your story in this wonderful new book, again called Saving Delaney, From Surrogacy to Family, published by Kleiss Press. And the co-authors, Andrea and Kesten Ottdahl. Kesten Ottdahl, I have so enjoyed this conversation. I so enjoyed the inspiring story of you and Andrea and Delaney. And wish all of you well. And I thank you for joining me today on The Morning Show to talk about your wonderful book.
Thank you so much for having us.
Tomorrow on The Morning Show, you're going to be meeting the most recent executive in residence at Carthage College, Christina Bruff. She is the economic development officer for the Bureau of African Affairs in the U.S. State Department, and she happens to be a Carthage grad as well. We look forward to meeting her in our studios and sharing our conversation with you on tomorrow's Morning Show. On Wednesday, also from Carthage College, Thomas Carr, who is the director of the paleontology program there. Recently, Professor Carr published a fascinating new paper which charts the overall history of Tyrannosaurus rex. And it's a fascinating history with still a few gaps that have yet to be fully understood and filled in. And we'll be talking with him about that on tomorrow's Morning Show. Thursday is the monthly visit of Nan Calvert, and her guest on Thursday, James Jastrzanka, is with Blue Ribbon Organics. We'll be talking about the joys of composting. On Friday, writer Jean Preston talks about a beautiful children's book she helped create called Banner and the Butterfly, which was written and published as a benefit for the Open Wings School here in Kenosha. Tells the beautiful story of a service dog named Banner. The Morning Show airs every weekday morning between 8 and 9 o'clock. The program is archived on our website, wgtd.org. Click on... Support for the Morning Show comes from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, a unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe, Andrea's, 2401 60th Street, online at andreasgifts.com. Support also comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses are designed for the working adult. More information is available at carthage.edu/grad. Supporting WGTD.